think we're ready. We're going to start with, I'm just going to introduce the speakers again to you. We've got David Morgan, who's going to be talking about intimacy and the difficulties of intimacy. We've got Matt Beef, who's going to talk about the economics of love under capitalism. We've got Candy talking about good enough jealousy, and she's going to be making a case for jealousy. What? And a case for Then we've got Yanis, who's going to be talking about miasma and the difficulty of maintaining loving bonds in society. Steve Fuller, who's going to, you're going to hate me when I paraphrase you. Well, I say that you are into abstraction as a survival skill in groups.
Well, that's kind of right, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Cool. And we've got Mariana, who's going to be ending up talking about the ethics of relationality. So we've got, we're sort of moving, as you can see, seamlessly, from intimacy in development, individual relations, and then more broadly in society.
Okay, can we hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Sad story, 1964, Valentine's Day. I sent a Valentine's Day to my girlfriend, Rhiannon Smith, who was the chief fire brigade daughter, made great interpretations, and I waited on Valentine's Day for my card to return, to get a card from somebody. I did, I got one card, and as usual, it was from my mother.
Not
understanding Oedipus complex. I will send me a card. So I didn't feel pain on Valentine's Day. I had no pain. The only card was from my mum. I was 14. There was hope. There was hope. I did okay later. Dorothy Parker. A life is an unending cycle of song.
The thallus,
thank you. Only got five.
That doesn't look like heckling.
Life is an unending cycle of song, a medley of extemporanea, and love is a thing that can never go wrong, and I'm a real Romania. Okay? Dorothy Parker had a few issues about men. So, in our world, you say that I work full-time as a psychoanalyst in private practice. I was going to read my lecture, but I'm going to extemporize now and see what happens. Because I think the space between two people is an extraordinarily difficult one to manage for lots of people. The space here is okay, I'm being slightly exhibitionistic. But intimate space is extremely difficult. And the people I see who come into analysis are people who I think find that space between two people enormously anxiety-provoking and do have a tremendous longing for it, a tremendous longing for love or relationship. We'll talk about the difference later on. And I think that longing for love or relationship drives people to seek it wherever they can find it. But most of the people I see haven't found it. And they come to psychoanalysts looking for love, actually. And this is a great discovery of Freud, that psychoanalysis is a transference cure based on the search for love. It's helping people manage that space between one another. And that space between two people is a space called, as we know, it's called intimacy. Now, why is intimacy so terrifying to people? And I think it's terrifying because love, relationship, the need for another human being, faces us with our most vulnerable aspects of ourselves. So when people come into analysis, quite often they talk about this thing that they're frightened of something. They know what it is. They're frightened of it, whatever it is. And human relationships, particularly one with an analyst, makes them begin for the first time to think about what it is. And another human being facing you and looking at you, engaging with you, or even loving you if you're lucky, I think makes you aware of this thing that we call it. And through analysis, one discovers that these things that people are frightened of in themselves, which I think you're made aware of, most made aware of by looking into the eyes of another human being who may feel something for you, are the facts of life. And there's nothing like a dependency of another human being to make you aware of the facts of life. And the facts of life are three facts of life. One is we're all born into dependent relationships from the beginning of the moment of life. We're born into a dependent relationship. And how that dependent relationship influences us is the beginning of a success or a failure in human relationships from then on. that first relationship is the beginning of dependency. And dependency is terrifying because it always involves those two things, life and death. All love is finite. All human relationships are finite. And how any of us manage that without creating these huge defenses to manage splitting, narcissism, fetishism, perversion, all sorts of ways of avoiding depends on another human being. Because human beings that make us most aware of ourselves make us most aware of our humanity. And the terrifying thing about humanity is, unlike love, or like love, it doesn't go on forever. Yeah. So the greatest defense against, I think, love or human relatedness is the awareness of limitations. Don Giovanni, for instance, a great interest of mine, is a man who avoided love completely. In the midst of one relationship, we went straight on to another. So at the beginning of one relationship, you already had somebody else in mind. So one way of avoiding the terror, I think, of human intimacy and love is to create a third in some form or another. Either promiscuous like Don Giovanni, or a fetish, or a drug, or an addiction, or a preoccupation, or something that provides you with an idea of infinity. I can always get a drug, I can always get alcohol, but the problem with the human relationship is the human relationships make you aware of the fact we're all finite, the most awful fact of life that all of us have to live with. And I think idealized love is the idea that you can love somebody perfectly forever. It's perfect, it's wonderful. I can look around the room and still see somebody in the back there who might be a perfect love for me. It's going to satisfy me forever. I will never have to face the reality of life, which real, genuine, deep intimacy forces me to be aware of. My partner ages, unfortunately, and that means I probably do too. So there is
there's narcissism for you.
I can avoid mirrors. So looking into another person's eyes who you have a deep relationship with makes you aware of the finiteness of life. And I think idealized love, which is, I think, that romantic love that we all long for and live for that moment in time, provides us with that sort of wonderful experience that everything joins up and everything's perfect. I hope you've had it at some point in your life. Rhiannon Smith was to me. You know. She, although it was unrequited, which of course is the best form of love, but you never have to face reality. So the worst part of love that all of us have to face is the fact that we're actually having a relationship with a real human being. The problem with real human beings is they make you aware that you're...
He's making sure we're listening.
That they make you aware of your reality, and the reality is the finite, and that's unbearable. So the three facts of life, outlined by Mandy Curl, who's a philosopher and psychoanalyst, is that we're all born in the three facts of life, and probably more. One is dependency on another human being. Yes. We're born from a couple, so far, still, I think that is a reality, so far. We're born from a couple, whether it's DIY or IVF, it doesn't matter. One is born from a couple. And the third fact of life, the most painful one, all of us have to face, we die. And the problem with the human relationships is that in the midst of love, there's also death. So the people I see who cannot find love are terrified of actually getting close to another human being, because the facts of life will be brought home to them. So one way of avoiding that is to pervert love, or pervert relationships. Distract yourself. Distract yourself from the reality of the other human being. Distraction, of course, means you can avoid living in the present. The problem with living in the present is it makes you aware probably of the reality of life. So finding a third, distracting yourself with something other than the human being you're with, is a way of avoiding perhaps the more painful aspects of life. So I would say that intimacy is extremely difficult for all of us. It's obviously easier to give a lecture to 7 to 5 people than to be with one person. Okay. Although, to be with one person, of course, is the only antidote and more painful aspects of life. Because companionship throughout life is what makes the more painful parts of life bearable. So that's my bit on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
I mean, we did speak before and you said you weren't going to go
to your palace.
Go to glue.
Lower your palace.
So
Thanks, Matt. So the reason why I'm on this panel is I co-authored a paper with a colleague of mine, Milena Sateva, who unfortunately can't be here this evening, which is, of course, a real shame for you guys because you miss out on her insights. And for me, the thing is, I'm the one who has to stand up and talk through what we wrote about.
We're loving you.
And notwithstanding what Elizabeth said about the difficulty particularly of talking about this subject, because of course love has a sort of unparalleled status in our culture, kind of ultimate aim, and as such, to stand up and talk about it, you leave yourself open to the accusation that you don't really know what you're doing and that you're doing love wrong in some way.
Yeah.
So of all the accusations you throw, please don't let that be one. And so, but basically, when Milena and I started thinking about this, we arrived at a preoccupation on modern society and modern ways of living and what they mean for the way that we love and the way that we think about love. And one of the first things we thought was, well, love in modern society has a lot of work to do. It's made to work hard. And as sort of traditional social structures and ways of binding people together, sort of religious or clan or potentially political associations received from public life, people are kind of left more on their own, in which situation the couple relationship, the love relationship, becomes invested with ever more importance and an ever greater number of roles. And so this sort of pop notion of the one who's the lover, who's the friend, who's the therapist, who's the confidant, you know, ever more roles get placed on that, and that obviously is a great depression. And I think, in addition to that, this sort of corresponds with a withdrawal from love in the social sphere and bringing it solely into the private sphere, and it's a kind of defensive move. As I think it's Mike Featherston noted, love runs the risk of becoming simply a battery charging unit away from the sort of troubles of the world kind of harbour against the open water. So that was our first thought on the matter. And second thought, although not only does modern society shape the way that our couples work, it also shapes the way that we actually conceive of love itself. And in this we had in mind the way in which sort of social relations based on exchange, capitalist social relations, and how they have sort of bled through into how we understand human relationships or personal human relationships. There's been a sort of metaphor creep that one way of reasoning has ended up infiltrating a different sphere. And in this notion, love becomes a sort of a quantity. It becomes something to be dispensed, to be spent on this or that person or this or that object. And while I think that, I mean, there is merit to a kind of economic view of love, we felt that this, in a crucial way, misunderstood the kind of properties of love. And actually, Elizabeth was kind enough when we were flagging to send me a copy of The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm.
I thought you needed
it. Yeah. Which looked hilariously like a self-help book. Not one to read on the tube. But it was exactly the inspiration I needed. Because he really skewers this point of view very well when he's talking about love as giving. And he says, and I'll read it, quote, the most widespread misunderstanding is that which assumes that giving is giving up something, being deprived of, or sacrificing. The marketing character is willing to give, but only in exchange for receiving. Giving without receiving for him is being cheated. And people whose orientation is a non-productive one feel giving as an impoverishment. And that way of viewing things and that sort of stance towards the world, I think, is very present in many of the relationship difficulties of modern life, and it's a sort of narcissistic or even depressive outlook, that you have a sort of a private store of love that you mustn't squander, that you mustn't spend on the wrong thing, that you might have to instead invest in your own impoverished self. And it does, I guess, less gloomy in a minute. I'm just, you know, taking it down. And of course, the sort of
the tragedy of the situation, or the way we came to look at it, was that, you know, it's people living by the wrong metaphor. They fail to realise that actually they're impoverished by this outlook, rather than, you know, love isn't something you can sort of conserve or bank, you know, perishable. So yes, that is all a bit gloomy. And the final part of our thinking on that was, what's a more appropriate metaphor for love? You know, what would help us get by this sort of the risk of the cycle of self-impoverishment? And we alighted, as you know, Eric Fromm did, on giving and on the gift as a sort of helpful metaphor. And we particularly came to Elizabeth Gross's definition of the gift, which I'll also read because I think it's helpful, which is that the gift and the modes of hospitality that it entails is an impossible yet imperative relation in which what is given cannot be what it is. The gift only functions in not being a gift. The moment an impulse to reciprocity or exchange is set up, one gift for another, the gift ceases to be a gift and becomes an object in a system of barter and exchange. And so the difficulty of the different metaphor for love is sort of established there. And this brings us back to Fromm and his view that love as giving shouldn't be seen as a sacrifice, and it shouldn't be seen as an altruistic act, because in fact one is enriched by giving rather than depleted by it. And so the final point about it is that it is actually quite important how we think about love. That, you know, it's not like, say, how we think about gravity. It doesn't really matter if you've fallen off a cliff, you know, it doesn't matter how you think about gravity, you're still falling. You know, love is not a mind-independent entity, and so the beliefs that we have about it actually do impact on how we'll act in the world and how we can relate to other people. And so, you know, worthwhile project thinking about.
I'm going to say a little bit about love, jealousy, and flirtation in popular culture. Focusing particularly, I'm going to look at male jealousy and flirtation. So I'm interested in questions of masculinity and emotion and popular culture. Well, from a Freudian perspective, jealousy is about the search for love and the loss of love, and it tests our ability to cope with feelings of wounded narcissism. Like David, I'm kind of echoing some of the themes in what you said. And yet living with uncertainty is easier said than done. Today it's often said we live in a narcissistic culture where the risks of love and attachment are warded off by avoiding emotional commitment altogether. At a time when the ethos of self-promotion is encouraged as a way of life, the losses of jealousy with its connotations of vulnerability and need are often equated with being a sort of sad loser, and there are endless self-help books you can read on how to cure your jealousy. Even what Freud called normal everyday feelings of jealousy have fallen out of fashion and have become a kind of source of embarrassment for those unlucky enough to experience it. Now, focusing on cinematic images of male jealousy, I mean, I've looked really at mainstream cinema here, I've explored the ways in which the meanings of male jealousy and the codes and certainties of jealous possession have changed and shifted in cinema. In addition, the very conditions of the dark auditorium may awake in the spectator an eroticized, voyeuristic wish to watch and imaginatively relive the rivalry scenes of Oedipal love when the wounds of jealousy, loss, and forbidden desire were first encountered. Jealous triangles lie at the heart of film melodrama. From films such as Rebecca and Mrs. Danvers and Max, Jane Fontaine, to the talented Mr. Ripley or Closer, and more recently Her, a key aspect of what I've called a kind of reparative or good enough jealousy in there. It's a capacity to live with difference without resorting to the destructive rivalrous subject positions when faced with the complexity of the other. And this links with the negative capability, which I should see on your thing. And yet in the context of heterosexual male jealousy, the threat posed by fantasies of the castrating other, the feminine engulfment, often loom large and are symbolised by the images of the deadly femme fatale, and unfortunately here the obvious one here is in Fatal Attraction, where the term bunny boiler was sort of coined in relation to that film with Glenn Close. And they tried out several kind of endings for that film. Initially, she wasn't going to be such a mad, sort of jealous person, but the audiences wanted her to be, and they went for that ending. So, in films such as those, the deadly woman carries the projections of male gaze and becomes the fearful green-eyed symbol of unacceptable desire. Now, Ernest Jones, in his essay on jealousy, said that one way to avoid the narcissistic wounds of jealousy is to flirt and make one's partner jealous instead. So today, jealousy and attachment may be defended against by avoiding commitment altogether, or, as you were saying, avoiding adopting the strategies of the Duan Huan, who deals with his potential jealousy by making others jealous instead. And I think flirtation is especially evocative in a mediatized sort of social networky culture, isn't it? Where people kind of flip from one image to another, to another, to another. Now, flirtation then can be linked to kind of mastery, sadistic control, and so on. But it's also can be read as playful and implies a kind of desire to challenge the old rules of the father. And Adam Phillips has written about this in his book on flirtation, and he uses Winnicott to explore that. And he says that it has its roots in early childhood, where the imaginary possibilities for love are not yet closed down by the customs of monogamy. So I'm quite interested in this kind of seesaw between jealousy, attachment, and flirtation, and whether that's, I'm trying to get my head around it. So I've moved from jealousy in my research now to flirtation. It's probably the wrong way around. So the dilemmas of masculinity and flirtation are there a lot in I'm beginning to look at these in cinema, and I've looked at Shame, and I gather these two films are in the Metro, which I haven't seen, but Nicola Diamond, who's here, pointed this out to me. I haven't yet even seen 50 Shades, but I hope that the dilemmas of possession and flirtation and so on, I'm sure they are, must be in there. American Hustle is another one, which is quite interesting to look at possession and the masquerade and flirtation and male flirtation and the defences around that, as symbolised actually in his wig, which he glues on and takes off. And keeps playing so as to not feel his own feelings of jealousy and possession for the one that he loves. So really, that's what I've been looking at, and I'd be really interested to hear anybody here about their thoughts about popular culture and images around jealousy and flirtation, so I can kind of nick them for my own research. Okay, thank you.
Moving on now to love more broadly in society.
Yes, I'll take love to a more wider level, politics, organizations, larger scale. And psychoanalysis, of course, holds no sentimental illusions about love. Love can be blind, it can be selfish, it can be foolish, and it can be cruel. But what I want to invite you to reflect is what the world would be like without love. Necessity alone, Freud reminds us, is not enough to hold groups together. is not enough to hold communities together. It is Eros, the power of love, that binds us together. It is Eros that neutralizes the destructive forces that all too easily surface and threaten the cohesion of any social unit. Yet, there is very little about love in the social sciences. Sometimes we encounter it in strange guises, like solidarity or attachment, but scarcely any social scientists speak about love. In my case, I spent quite a long time in an organization which was conspicuously without love. And that drove home to me the sheer bleakness of such an outfit. This was not a machine-like bureaucracy without emotion. There was certainly a lot of emotion, but not very much love. And there was generalized feelings of worthlessness and depression, an absence of any will to resist, and an abject expectation of disaster and punishment. But maybe above all, what really impressed me about this organization was the sense of pollution and uncleanliness, the feeling that it was like a disease-like condition that was impossible to resist because it attacked the participants from inside. And this is why I use the word miasma to describe the situation in that organization. As a Greek person, miasma is a very powerful word to me. It's a word that we encounter in many Greek tragedies, representing a contagious state of pollution, which is material, psychological, but also spiritual, and descends plague-like on a family, on a community, on a city, on a kingdom, and affects everybody without discriminating between deserving and undeserving people. It is a highly toxic state that corrupts and institutional and moral fabrics. Anybody who's read Thucydides' description of the plague in Athens in 429 BC immediately recognizes this. Above all, it dissolves love bonds and leaves a community dominated by fear, guilt, hate, despair, and lies. Individuals becoming increasingly isolated from each other in deep solitude, isolation, and despair. What makes miasma really fascinating is that attempts to cleanse the city of miasma merely reinforce the condition. In fact, purification very often has the opposite effect. One feature of miasma is the search for scapegoats. And the search for scapegoats, to me, is a sure sign of a pollution-like condition. Thus, for example, Oedipus is expelled from Thebes, his city, as a way of ridding Thebes of the pollution that he has brought through his actions. But of course, the expulsion of Oedipus merely perpetuates that miasma, as his sons kill each other in battle, as his daughter gets buried alive, and so on and so forth. In fact, the search for scapegoats is, for me, the clearest sign. Now, in organizations that are gripped by miasma, we have a double scapegoat. The leaders of such organizations tend to scapegoat the old leadership, and those members of organizations that are seen as dead wood, which bring the organization down, and they view downsizing as the necessary cleansing ritual through which they can restore their organization to health and prosperity. They get rid of the old woods, so to say. However, the downsizing itself, the bleeding of an organization by its ruthless leader, is experienced by many organizational members as the real bringer of the miasma. Now, the link between miasma, pollution, and the dissolution of the bonds of love are driven home to us in a wonderful passage by Freud in his essay on mourning and melancholia, where he says, "The distinguishing features of melancholia are a profoundly painful dejection, cessation of interest in the outside world, loss of the capacity to love, inhibition of all activity, and a lowering of the self-regarding feelings to a degree that finds utterance in self-reproaches and self-revilings. Freud observed many similarities between melancholia and mourning, but noted a key difference. Melancholia, like mourning, is a response to loss or separation, but one in which the subject does not know what it is that he or she has lost. Scapegoating is an effort to create precisely such an agent and blame this agent for the loss. As a social condition, melancholia is often linked to various witch hunts, pogroms, persecutions, whose brutality is only matched by their irrationality. What is true of organizations is also true of societies at large. And one feature that has particularly preoccupied me of late is the idea of parasites, the idea of the parasite who is the obvious agent of decline, pollution, and so forth, and has to take the blame. The person who takes without giving back, related to what we heard before from Matt, and this very easily becomes the feature attached to scroungers, loafers, so forth, migrants, and the bringers of miasma to our societies. As a Greek, I have become aware of how readily my own country has been assigned the role of Europe's parasite, along maybe with some other Mediterranean countries, especially in the populist German press. The Greeks have been happy to live beyond their means, sucking resources from the ever-benevolent European family, giving nothing back. So instead of solidarity or love on a large scale, the Greek economic and social plight has met with hostility and sometimes venom. But what is represented by Greece on the European scale? In Greece itself is often represented by displaced and immigrant people, refugees from persecuted countries, who are seen as those bringing devastation and ruin to the country. So it is ironic for me that the European project that sought to put an end to centuries of loathing and hate and rancor is currently discovering new ways of targeting groups and populations as the bringers of miasma. Now, political and organizational leaders who preach love can easily be ridiculed and cynicism heaped upon them. These are, of course, phenomena closely associated to the palpable absence of love. Yet it seems to me that organizations, communities, and even societies that exile love are the ones that draw themselves closer to darkness in the abyss. Thank you.
Well, that's a tough act to follow as far as grooming is concerned, but maybe I can top it. First of all, let me apologize on my voice is hoarse, but maybe that might limit the amount of time I speak. What I want to talk about here is a kind of form of love that in a way really hasn't been highlighted yet, but it is one that Freud dealt with in a rather dismissive way, actually, but it's one that is very much part of the Western tradition with regard to love, and that is what's called in the Greek agape, which is some kind of a sense of a universal love. That is to say, a sense of love that's often contrasted with eros, where in the idea of eros is a sense of some kind of, as David was saying, a sense of intimacy that often comes from a dependency. There's a kind of attraction going on. But in the case of agape, it's a much more abstract thing. And what exactly the nature of that kind of love that, let's say, enables Christians to say that they have love for all human beings, even the ones they've never been in contact with. That's the kind of question that we're talking about here. And it's interesting when you look at Freud's works in Civilization and Discontents, he has a discussion, a small discussion, about this idea of agape, which he is very skeptical about. And in a way, it's a kind of an interesting inversion of the kind of thing Matt was talking about, because Matt was, in a sense, talking about the way in which we often see love as being something on a budget, right? If you give it to someone else, you're somehow taking it away
from yourself, and you know, you gotta be careful how you invest it. But what Freud's worried about in terms of agape is actually unconditional love, where you just keep on giving and giving, and you don't care how the other person responds. Right? And here's what, and the context that he's talking about here, is actually, what he's seeing in the early days of the Soviet Union, where you have this kind of, you know, these kind of 5-year plans and this dispossession of land, all in the name of some kind of common humanity, you know, and even if it kills you, we're going to recognize your common humanity. And what is involved in the process of this kind of unconditional love on the part of the state is a radical transformation of the life circumstances of most of the people there. Okay? And the thing is that it doesn't, there's no way of stopping it in a sense, right? Because it's so principled. And Freud thinks this is kind of, in a way, the ultimate perversion of love, because if there is any kind of psychological basis for love, it isn't the kind of thing that David was talking about with regard to dependency and intimacy and things of that kind. Now, one of the things that's quite interesting about the way in which the discussion of agape has gone in recent times, is that, there is a kind of an attempt to bring in a kind of more dependency-based notion of agape, basically, often in a kind of ecological context, you might say, where we're sort of mutually dependent on each other to keep the planet afloat, and this includes not just human beings, but animals and things of that kind. And so there's a kind of universal sense of love kind of built into that sort of notion. And this has actually been quite popular with a lot of what's now, if you know anything about social theory at the moment is going through what's called a post-secular period, where in a sense people are trying to recover a lot of these sorts of religious ideas, but within a kind of more or less secular vein. And this is the way in which agape, the idea of what historically was Christian love, gets kind of reinvented. Now, I think that there, you know, is this adequate or not as a way of kind of trying to understand what agape is? Is it some sense of kind of a radical sense of mutual dependency that extends not just between the people that we have, you know, face-to-face interaction with in our ordinary relations, but includes the whole planet and everything? I think it's a tricky issue. And here, you know, I think the one way is to test the intuitions on this, because I actually do think the notion of agapic love is quite a powerful notion. It actually has motivated a lot of very important transformations that people have been willing to make of themselves and others. And so I don't want to dismiss in the way that Freud did this idea of unconditional love as always being just sort of a license for violence, basically. But one has to, you know, get a grip on what exactly are we talking about then. And so in terms of testing your intuitions on this, I think, you know, the story that everyone always goes back to when trying to illustrate what the nature of agapic love is the tale of the Good Samaritan. Okay? And this is a story that's invoked by St. Augustine in the 5th century as a way of kind of illustrating what agapic love is. And so the question then becomes, so we've basically got this, we've got this guy on the road who's injured, and there's no particular reason why the traveler who's going across should actually take care of this guy, and you have some understanding that the road is relatively risky, and you're not sure whether this person is actually really injured or maybe just pretending, and then you're going to be jumped. I mean, all these kinds of issues are actually part of the original context of the narrative. So there's a kind of an uncertainty there. So what the story is trying to get you to do is that you can't, the whole idea that you might immediately feel some kind of sympathetic bond, like if I were in your position, I would want someone to help me, that kind of thing, is really, the story is designed in such a way to actually eliminate that, right? But nevertheless, you are somehow, you know, the good person is the one who actually does do this. So there's a sense in which you're overcoming a lot of negative feelings that you actually have toward the other person, or at least fear, you know, feelings of uncertainty, risk, fear, things of that kind, and somehow transcending that in order to, you know, come up to the situation where you actually help the other person. And so then the question is, what is the source of that? Now, St. Augustine, for his part, and this is where the notion of charity originally comes from, in caritas in Latin, he believed that actually when you're looking at the Samaritan, you're not just seeing this kind of potentially dodgy person you're taking a risk on helping, but rather you somehow see Jesus in this person. Okay? In other words, you see something completely different from what the normal person would see in this person. Okay? But the problem with saying Jesus is an attractive figure. Right? I mean, so there's a sense in which what Augustine is in fact doing, and this is the way in which Augustine had been historically interpreted in the history for most of Christianity, was in a way finessing this issue, right? So in other words, you bring in some sense of attractiveness at a kind of second order level, right? You see Jesus, and Jesus is definitely attractive. Okay. Exactly. So now, interestingly, I don't want to go on and give you the whole history of Christianity here, but the interesting thing about the Protestant Reformation in this context, and then I'll finish, is that the Protestant Reformation, what it did to this notion was really to go back to the beginning and say, no, actually, it's really an important part of agape that you really don't like the person in some visceral way, and that in some sense you're engaged in a different kind of relationship, right? You're thinking about this person in a completely different way. In the article for the ebook, I talk a little bit more about that, and I won't go into it here, but except to say that Martin Luther King, okay, when he was engaged in his civil rights activism and had to deal a lot with all of the, you know, the bigoted whites and so forth, he was theologically trained, and when he discusses the sense of love that one needs to have, right, he's quite explicit that he actually hates those white people. In their the way they actually manifest themselves, but then he understands them at a different level, which, you know, he interprets as being children of the same God or something of that kind. But that's a really different kind of love. That is a love that does not at all try to trade on this idea of attractiveness of people at some deeper level or something of that kind. It is actually trying to present itself as a different kind of love, where the economy of love is radically different, where there is a justification there for a kind of unconditional love, where you can, in principle, just give without expecting anything back in return. Okay, and that's kind of where I think where agape is kind of a very interesting notion. And Freud, I think, was just fundamentally skeptical that that sort of idea could exist without actually being a license to violence in the end. And that's kind of the challenge put for us.
Thank you.
Okay, so good evening, and thank you very much, Elizabeth, and thanks to the Freud Museum for giving me this opportunity. So what I'm going to talk about is why societies can't survive without love. So again, societal perspective. And from St. Paul's proclamation of love exceeding everything, I quote, "If I have all faith, so as to move mountains that would not have love, I'm nothing." To the Beatles, song being hummed by Her Majesty Queen during her Diamond Jubilee, "Love is All We Need," as the Beatles song went on. In popular culture and literature, we all agree that love is something desirable, something we all want. But actually, as my former speakers have already established, both philosophers, ethicists, psychologists, psychoanalysts differ in their conception what is love, and in fact, what sort of love do we all need? Do we all need the same kind of love? What kind of love? So I think the psychosocial conception of human development explains very aptly and very, how can you say, in a very relevant, very contemporaneous way, why do all we need love, starting from our early development, when we need this positive reinforcement as we mirror ourselves in the carers of mothers, gaze. Moving on further, as Lacan, Jacques Lacan told us, we form affective attachments to values and to people who represent those values. So many ancient Greeks tried to talk about different types of love, agape being just this love for humankind, but they also talk about eros as a love for physical object, or for Plato, for the idea of the object, and they also talked about philia, which is brotherly love, or what I call relationality, love for the other. And that's what I want to actually, that's my kind of minor contribution to this lies. So I'm very influenced not only by Freud, but more by how feminist post-structuralists who are influenced, by psychoanalysts like Judith Butler and Henrietta Moore speak about love and speak about ethical imagination, love as a means of our imagining our relationship to ourself and the other, and therefore love as a means for enacting different politics. Because I would argue, and I'm sure many of you probably will agree with me on that, that all our politics are affective and are emerging through attachments. And we have a passion for seeing things differently. We have a passion for doing things differently. And as Steve was actually arguing, our ethical imagination is that through our relation to the other, through the fact that we define ourselves vis-à-vis the other, who is like ourselves, as by identification, or different, and therefore we know who we are. We are not subsumed by the other, and the other has to be different. And Judith Butler has a very interesting example when she talks that in order for us to exist socially, we have to be recognized by the other, or the big other, as Lacan would have it, meaning the symbolic other. And people develop attachments that can be very injurious, like gay people have original contribution, right? Gay people actually attach to the derogative and injurious terms in order to be recognized who they are. And what the Yannis was saying these days, as I read all this, how can I put it? Hurtful would be one way, as a Greek person, as Yannis said, as a Greek person, hurtful, but it's not just about Greek, it's just about who is that other in a different point in time. This, at this moment, because the politics are played in the way they are played, we have all the zoomorphic, you know, pigs. We have the parasite, the medicalized, and we know where that does that lead us, the medicalized metaphors, right? We have all these medicalized metaphors or animalistic metaphors, but there is something different. It's just where those relational ties of love are severed, in my personal view. And as Judith Butler... Sorry, I just need to... Well, I probably tried to say that she says that much, much better than I, needless to say. But she actually says that since we are very precarious, our beings are precarious, in the way David explained, Freud has established, since love binds us to eros, binds us to life, but at the same time it coexists with Thanatos, with death drive, which is necessary for existence, for our drive as well, for being here and being out there, so to speak. What I'm trying to say is, since love binds us to life, and love is the only means that can counteract that precarity in that sense. So by recognizing that the other is as precarious as I am, I fight for my own and I protect my own survivability, as Judith Butler would say. It is not just because I care about the other who is different and with whom I may never fully reconcile myself, I can never fully identify, so to speak. It's this other, this Levinasian other, has to be accepted for what she or he is, because only through this I can exist. So just to kind of conclude on ethical imagination through psychoanalysis and through, various progressive movements, that feminism is one of them in my personal view, we can think about a different relationship through the other and therefore about different politics. Thank you very much.
Words Jesus was really attractive. I just needed to do it. Hilarious. Now, I'm going to move gently amongst you and start to encourage you to think about some questions. We've got some amazing stuff. Parasites, scapegoating, good enough jealousy, negative capability, good luck stuff. No pressure. Surely.
Don't be bashful.
Thank you so much for your amazing presentation. Very thought-provoking, and it's almost like I would like to ask everybody questions and comments. It's very moving presentation from David about intimacy. Thank you. I thought, so lots of ideas. I love that you mentioned American Hustle. It's very interesting because the other woman is the good woman in that film. That's another whole matter we should discuss. I just wanted to make a little point about Levinas and Agape, because that was mentioned in passing. And I think there are two things that I should say about it. So Lacan, in his Seminar 7, talks about, quite disparagingly, about the notion of Christian love, in terms of also Agape, and he mentions an incident which is, I think it's a different incident, it's not Samaritan, but it's St. Martin's, as the idea of giving a cloak, and he says, yeah, right, but, you know, frankly, we don't know really what goes on there. It might be that the beggar really would want to be loved properly, and he says, and you won't forgive me, he says perhaps the beggar might have been fucked rather than being given this charity. So that's one something to put to you. And secondly, and I kind of just thought this was rubbish with Freud, that it, you know, it's not the real thing. And secondly, the levelness on responsibility, which is a slightly different idea, and my students always have huge difficulty understanding it, even though it's very simple, so I wanted to see what you think, which is different from agape and the infinite responsibility for the other who enters your space, and then you just simply have to be responsible for them.
I think in the case of the Good Samaritan, in that parable, I think the key thing that, because see, in the way you're presenting this other parable from in terms of Lacan, is like there is some kind of other better state that would have been preferred by the person who's receiving the help. It's not clear in the Good Samaritan there's really anything like that, because the alternative state that's envisaged is ignoring him. Right? I mean, it's not a matter of fucking him, right? It's either ignoring him or helping him, okay? And you're putting yourself potentially at risk by helping him, right? And so, and then the story also says everybody else has been ignoring him, right? So you're doing something kind of out of the ordinary too, that's another thing. So I think that the parable does kind of matter in terms of trying to get the concept straight. I mean, now, the business of the infinite responsibility for the other, I do think that is very much in the spirit of agape, but the question then is, what kinds of actions does that license? Right? Because if the other isn't fully incorporated into you, right, I mean, I think that this is the kind of thing that Freud thought was an illegitimate move, in a way, was that you can then somehow imagine the other as some kind of version of your ideal self, which then gives you a license, you know, to kind of work out on that person, perhaps things you can't deal with in yourself, right? And I think that that's the downside of it, and why, you know, Freud and the Freudians would be very suspicious of that idea. But I think infinite responsibility for the other is actually a good way of capturing what the concept is trying to get at. It's just what it looks like in practice, right, where the problems start.
Agnieszka, thank you very much. I just now have my glasses on, so I can fully say, well, Judith Butler said so much more eloquently than I. If I seek to preserve your life, it is not only because I seek to preserve my own, but because who I am is nothing without your life, and life itself has to be rethought as this complex, passionate, antagonistic, I underline, this antagonistic, and necessary set of relations to others. So I mean, I always have issues with big fathers, you know, that's why I prefer, you know, mothers, or sisters, or just, you know, others. And in that case, feminine interpretation of Lacan, like Judith Butler does. And so what I was trying to say is that I think one cannot be naive that ethical demand of infinite responsibility for the other. And let us not forget, when Levinas was writing what he was writing, and from which position was he writing what he was writing, right? After the Second World War, he himself being a Jewish philosopher and all that. So, drawing a historical experience, which is so dangerous, to position a whole group of people, whoever they are, as the others, as the infinite others, and therefore not, how can I say, not worth grieving for, as Judith Butler puts it again,
people who don't have livable lives, and therefore they are not worth grieving. And we can see how the war on terror is being commanded. We don't see people. We used to see people in previous kind of wars, like Vietnam War, and we identify with them, we see the face, the famous face, Levin Asiel and all that. And now we see just kind of these aliens who are the, you know, the occupying force in my terminology. And then we see, we don't see people basically. Who are those? Whom are they fighting against? Well, drones take that to another level. Yeah. So I'm not going to get into that. But what I'm trying to say is this for me, that the ethical responsibility is to understand that we have to be irreconcilably others. And we cannot fully understand the other. That's not the point. It's just how, and you're absolutely right, Steve, in what way can we live together as others? And when you read it, today's kind of popular press, and not only popular press, especially in those texts, I'm sorry, that actually, oh, cultural differences, oh, those people are so different than us, they can't live by our standards, they should be too close to us. You know, I think that is, you know, I don't know, that is really, really a very dangerous territory we are entering, and all demons have been just kind of popping up. That is in front of me in any case. Sorry, I don't know if I've answered your question. I want to say that I don't believe that you can reconcile otherness till the very end or incorporate the other as Christians. I'm not Christian, but I... Oh, God, okay. Maybe that's why. Sorry.
The gentleman who spoke about miasma, I just wanted to ask, what do you think creates miasma within an organization or within a culture in the first place? Why does it manifest? What happens? Because I didn't really get to understand that, as it were.
Yeah, the answer is very simple. I think it's the ability to grieve, to mourn, and to accept change.
I find the responsibility for others a bit confusing, because I know, I'm completely uninformed about Freud or anything like that past the introduction to psychology class in university. I always thought people already got over him, but when I'm walking by somebody who's in distress, for me it's kind of a long-term avoidance of guilt. Like, if I help them, then I kind of feel good about myself. If I don't help them, I will forever wonder, what if they were in distress? What if, you know, what if I could have done something? So in a way, it's a self-preservation that I'm helping somebody else. And I think it is, for me at least, I recognize it as something selfish through a selfless act. Has that ever, well, it's probably come up, I don't know. But this is like a question from somebody who has no idea about
the theory that we're talking about.
Oh, yeah,
there we go.
Okay.
Friends.
Oh,
the panel,
would you like to have a go?
Yes, I'm a philosopher, but I was just because some of the themes that have been coming up about rescuing people or helping people that don't really want to be helped. And I was thinking of Freud and the rescue motif and the kind of fantasy of rescuing and setting up a kind of three... picks up on what you're saying, but a third, so you can rescue the woman from somebody. And then I was thinking about the film The Searchers and how this happens with Uncle Ethan, you know, John Wayne, who goes off and does this kind of rescue romance fantasy with his niece. And then Scorsese took this up in Taxi Driver, where we saw that kind of heroic, so-called heroic narrative, her parodied and critiqued, and he linked this to Vietnam and about the way in which American foreign policy was about rescuing countries that didn't really want to be rescued. And what was that about in terms of narcissism and machismo and politics? And so I'm kind of thinking about that in terms of what David's been saying and popular culture and so on, and I'm sure there are other movies at the moment that one could also see this at work.
Yeah, I mean, I fully understand where you're coming from on this idea of feeling guilty if you don't help the person. But in a way, I think that kind of view, in a way, doesn't quite capture the spirit of what the parable is supposed to get at in the sense, because the parable is trying to appeal to your sort of autonomous sense of self in the sense, right? So in other words, it's almost like noblesse oblige, right? That you're doing this because it is within you, have this kind of larger goodness within you to do it. It's not because you feel guilty because there's an internal censor that's going to get back at you and say, hey, you should have helped that guy. But it's rather something that comes directly from you. And I think that, and this is, within the context of the way Jesus gives his messages, he's really always talking about people to become, as it were, bigger people than they really are, right? Right, they're not just supposed to be people who are responding to normative pressure and guilt in the ordinary sense, or even kind of fellow feeling and some kind of immediate sense of dependency, but rather somehow appealing to a kind of higher, divine mentality in a sense. It makes you incredibly magnanimous. And so you'll even be willing to put yourself potentially at personal risk to help the other person. And that's the spirit in which he's trying to encourage this, and that's the basis for agape. And the question is whether that's an authentic feeling, right? I think that's the kind of question that the Freudians put on the table, is that really authentic, or is that a mask for something else that's going on, right? Like maybe a kind of really overweening sense of narcissism that then licenses you to do all kinds of things that you wouldn't do if you were just an ordinary narcissist, because you'd be afraid to do it. Right? I think that's kind of the issue that the Freudians put on the table with regard to agape, because agape is actually appealing to you at a very high level. Right? So you're supposed to be operating by a totally different motive than the one you're talking about. Because of course that, what you're saying, is quite recognizable. But that's not agape.
Maybe I'm just a humble narcissist.
Well,
yeah, you're one's friends.
I'm just saying, where are the Freudians in? They never disturbed the estimate.
Where are you going?
There's a lady right at the back. I'm going to prioritize that.
Hiya. We've been talking about love as a kind of end state that everyone's aiming for. But for me, love is more of a travel, like a journey. And very often people start with loving someone else for something, and then kind of move towards loving despite things. So I love you even though you're impatient, or even though you've got all those negative things that I don't like about you, but I still love you. So I just kind of wonder what are your thoughts on loving for and loving despite. Oh.
Yeah, sorry. I do think this actually does. When I was alluding at the end to the business about Martin Luther King and the sort of Protestant take on agape, that is actually quite explicitly involving a dislike of the way people actually behave, and a dislike of the way people really are. So people are racist. It's not that you somehow condone it and therefore you reach out to them. No, you dislike it just as much, but it's in spite of that, right, that you love them. Right, so I do think that there is that is part of the interpretation of agape, is to actually love in spite of all the obstacles the person themselves put in the way of your approaching them.
Can I just say one sentence? For me, love is protecting life. I mean, I know it sounds like just very basic. We live in a time of biopolitics. I mean, biopolitics are moving very close to our own neighborhood, right? Biopolitics were always there, but they're now moving to our neighborhood. So what I'm talking about is something much more modest, actually. And that endless act of charity in a Christian way, ignores the power dynamics on which it is based, which for me is untenable, personally. I'm not saying that one shouldn't be capable of moral acts of charity. That's not what I'm saying. But basically, the whole premise of ethical, kind of position on helping, in a way that actually ignores the whole difference of power differentials, I don't think it's very helpful, at least from my point of view. Thank you.
One of the things that maybe we failed to notice, and Elizabeth mentioned before, we haven't mentioned the S word, sex. And I think that Freud's conceptualization of love is never removed from sex.
Right.
And I think to forget about sex when talking about love and to get wrapped up with all kinds of Christian and other variants emasculates the...
Emasculates the most vital features of...
Now, I think that if psychoanalysis tells us anything, is that love is protean. It has many different... It assumes many different forms. And sensual pleasure is a vital, important, and integral part of it. It also, very often, gets mixed up with death states. So sadism is love. But it is love which is destructive, which is blind, which is profoundly immoral. I think that somewhere, in more than one place, Freud says that the only uncontaminated love, and I think there is a little bit of a naive Jew, as against the Catholic and the Protestant, very interested within here, where he says only the mother's love for her son is unadulterated with any feelings of resentment, etc., etc. But I think that we need to broaden up, and I'm profoundly uncomfortable about these discussions about the other, this metaphysical entity. The other can be our brother, it can be our sister, it can be our mother, it can be our fellow citizen, it can be our fellow trade unions. And Freud has a very good way of talking about the other through the idea of identification. And we don't need a god to identify with other people as children of a single monotheistic father-like god. We can identify with other people by virtue of shared qualities, shared values, and shared ideas. But even then, you can't really get rid of the sexual, sensuous dimension of love, however much we may be tempted to do so.
I wanted to pick up on your question at the back. Unfortunately, plus David, he's got to go and look after his dad this evening. But in the e-book that we produced for this event, he talks about Keats's idea of negative capability, which is really I didn't know about this, and I don't know why, because I'm now going to use it all the time. I don't know if it's an excuse for ignorance. However, I'm going to give you the quote on what negative capability is, which might speak to your question. The ability to contemplate the world without the desire to try and reconcile contradictory aspects or fit it into a closed and rational system. Helpful? I've got this question, and then you.
Okay. I was thinking about a couple of things. One is the concept of beauty and the good of the object, and especially in the terms of Mother's concept of apprehension of beauty. I don't know if you've heard about it. They don't teach him anywhere. It's a profound study. So this is the idea that he says all the mothers are the most beautiful women in the world. If you speak to a patient, he always tells you, my mother was a very beautiful woman, to the point of statistical impossibility that so many beautiful women. It's impossible. But of course, it is the quality of beauty of the quality of the beauty of the object is because of what values or qualities that object has in relation to you. And of course he says the problem with that is that you can never ever know that object, which is why he calls it apprehension, where you have that sort of fear, maybe hatred, maybe unwillingness to actually stay in that connected relationship. And he also says, and that's the sort of second point I was thinking of, about passion, what I think you were talking about. And in terms of Bion, passion is described with LHK, love, hatred, and knowledge, or at least wanting to know and knowing that you can never know that person.
Okay, I'm going to take all three questions and then throw that to Bion.
Thanks. I'm saying this as somebody who's looking at love from a social science perspective, and also somebody who's spent many years in psychoanalysis, so to preface it. But I'm kind of thinking that you can't intellectualize love. It's kind of really kind of interesting how we kind of started with this kind of sense of really feeling it. Longing, love, jealousy, shame, all of those things. And we've kind of moved on to this kind of intellectual debate about it, which is kind of fascinating. And I think part of it is about psychoanalysis. We can say that because we're seeing, you know, in his gaze. Well, I think that this, there's something that incredibly important that David said that he kind of left now, but you kind of, that, you experience it in the process. You know, you, that struggle between one human being and another, and that, that kind of desire to get close but not being able to. It's those kind of issues that are all about love. It's not about, you know, concepts of a gap in, blah, blah, blah. I mean, actually, interesting, I grew up in Greece as a child, and in my experience of growing up in Greece as a child, a gappy was actually about a longing, a kind of desire. It was about true love. It wasn't about this, this idea about helping somebody else.
More than Greeks gone to dogs. That's what you are.
I would just like to say something about sameness and difference and love. I mean, when we have a romantic period, when we're in a honeymoon period, we often mean mirroring in the other, and identification has that sense of mirroring. You know, I find myself in the other. And for me, when we talk about an ethics of, you know, a social ethics, I think an ethics of difference is important. And one of the things that Lacan says, I'm not saying I'm really taking up in the Lacanian perspective, but I found it a bit confusing because I think we got sameness and difference confused somewhat, is that we can't fully recognise ourselves in the other. But rather than seeing that as a problem for love, that makes love possible. Because it's the joy of the tension, it's the joy of the friction, it's the joy of always something different to find out about the other. And it's appreciating the other doesn't feel the same as me. And trying to reach out to understanding that. And for me, love is about difference, even a difference. And I think it's not just about personal difference, me and my lover, but it's about cultural difference, enjoying differences politically, socially, etc. So love, for me, is an ethics of difference. That's the kind of love I want to fight for.
Right, okay, we have three questions for the microphone, please.
Thank you. Three wonderful comments that we could spend a long, long time reflecting about them. I just have one reflection, which is in response to my fellow social scientist's observation about love as an experience. And I think that that's absolutely true. But the reason why we look at psychoanalysis is because we become suspicious of experience. We may experience a lot of things in life, but our experience very often deceives us. We can experience something because we are in denial of something else. We can idealize, as the other two questions very nicely alluded to, because our love makes us oblivious to the flaws and problems that stares in the eye. And I think that one of the really valuable concepts that Freud did introduce was the notion of the love for truth, which sometimes can bring people together, especially when confronting prejudice, bigotry, and systematic, fanatical ideas that clearly stand in the way of truth. And I think that this is an idea to vindicate the shared love of truth.
Just very quickly, wonderful comments indeed, and I say absolutely 150% to the last commenter, and I'm just kind of trying to see you. Absolutely agree, that's what I was trying to convey, but you said that better. Okay, yeah, social science. I think that the dualism between actually, you know, like a body and thought and all that, in social science, it's just collapsing, you know? So I think trying to think through your body, actually, and indeed, yes, ancient Greeks talked about eros for physical body, no? For object. Yeah? Okay. So what I'm trying to say, that's part and parcel. Why one or the other?
Who would argue these days those things? Nobody would argue those things. And you experience, and this is about values, this is the final thing, I say nothing more tonight, but the final thing I want to say is this, that you actually reimagine, through reimagining the relationship with the other, you are attached to other values that this other represents as well, perhaps. Perhaps not, because it's an agonistic relationship with the other, no? You don't assume the other. So I wasn't probably, okay, I'm an academic, but I wasn't arguing for actually, you know, taking the step back and rationalizing that or actually reflecting as disembodied human being. That's never possible in my personal view. Thank you.
Yeah. I suppose I really resonated to what she said. And when I was exploring jealousy, few years ago, actually, what I wanted to look at was some of the themes that we've explored, which is the messiness, really, of experience and the tensions of difference, which have also been discussed, which touch on the notion of negative capability. And that space, that kind of existential emotional space that you occupy when... when we're threatened with the grief and loss that Freud talked about in Mourning and Melancholia, and not to move into another space which has been described by Klein in terms of envy or in terms of a modern melancholic thing. And I suppose I am making a plea for them, for that kind of messy, embodied nature of the subject and humanity and the human aspect of us.
And I would also like to respond to your comment and sort of almost say, you know, it's a fair cop. There has been some intellectualising going on. And it struck me because I was writing with somebody else and so we go off into a room to discuss love. And it was much more comfortable for us to go straight to the societal, to the economic, to the philosophical. Yeah. And there was an aspect of our personal experience that we never got to actually come out with. And that may be partly because it would feel like a betrayal of the person, or the sort of intimacy with another person. But I was aware of that. I also thought we all were quite gloomy the topic was love and we all came out with the worst possible things we could think of. but anyway, I suppose to return to the... The first point was the most true, that it is very difficult to insert that personal honesty. I'm not doing it here, but I'm going closer than I did before, but I'm still not doing it. Anyway.
Okay, this is going to be our final question. I think it's really interesting when I consider Eros that I think of the boy with the weapon. And I always think it's something that hits you. which kind of goes back to experience. There's also something that kind of pierces you in a way that you have to kind of represent it. You have to intellectualize it. Because it goes somewhere that it's almost like how hysteria used to be thought of as something that you use around the body. And I think that's why it's so difficult to find any one way of looking at it. And just one more point. I really liked the notion of the scapegoat, because the scapegoat has the cure, the poison and the cure contained within it. And it's supposed to, it gets sent away and it's supposed to do something to the society, but actually there's always a remnant, there's always something that stays. Whether it be guilt, whether it be, I mean, just thinking about, you know, survivor guilt or anything like that, something survives, something stays, and I think that, again, that hits you. And
that's just fair. Yeah. Okay.
That was not just.
That was profound. Does anybody want to respond?
No.
I think. So listen, we're coming towards the end of our time together. I'm just going to remind you that you have cards which are asking you to write down what you know about love. And then it's going to go up on our online Love Amateurs Library. So if you're stuck, for a moment, you know, a bit bored, you can write something down about love. I'm going to ask one final question to our panel members, you can answer randomly, which is, what is your top tip for love?
Top tip for love?
Yeah.
Well, when you fall in love with somebody, check out what their relationship is with their mother.
I mean, I kind of knew this question was coming, and there's not a non-glib way to answer it, I don't think. I found myself earlier today re-watching the final scene of Bill and Ted's Bogus Adventure, where Aristotle communicates, be excellent to one another. And literally, I have nothing really beyond this.
Well, you don't have to, you don't.
Well, enjoy it while it lasts. Once again, I can't top that. I guess all I would say is be open-minded. That's the way I would look at it. If you want to be open to love, you've got to be open-minded.
Oh my gosh, that's quite difficult. Yeah.
You think you have to do it,
man. I have to do it. All right. Yeah, I think it's, you know, like 100 small steps a day, 100 small compromises a day, basically. I know it sounds very mundane. 100 small compromises a day just to keep the love alive, basically.
Not at all.
Yeah, anyway, sorry, mundane.
Mine is, I wrote a piece about solidarity, about working with activists. I've been a political activist most of my life. I'm working in trade unions. And I wrote about, and I rethought my ideas about the relationships of love between, you know, brotherly love. And I started to realise that actually a lot of the sort of pressures that we put each other under are really passionate. They're really passionate love. So, but of course, we've got superegos the size of tanks. So I say that about people who work in mental health as well. So I speak to myself here. My advice about love is to be less busy and to spend more time with people.
Tell us what you know about love. Lovely lady in the back there is going to be collecting them, and she will also be giving out your CPD certificates. Yes, you now love experts. CPD stands for completely passionate about dependence.
I'm going to go back to the next one. Thank you. Thank you very much.